From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump tweeted today that he never directed his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, to break the law. Cohen was sentenced to 3 years in prison yesterday on a number of charges, including campaign finance violations involving those hush money payments to two women who said they'd had affairs with then-candidate Trump. Cohen said under oath that he made those payments at Donald Trump's direction. And yesterday, prosecutors in New York revealed that the publisher of the National Enquirer, AMI, also admitted to working with the Trump campaign to make a payment to one of the women, Kara McDougal, buying her story to bury it, something called capture and kill in the tabloid world. And also the paper's publisher and longtime Trump pal David Pecker contacted Michael Cohen when the paper found out another woman, Stormy Daniels, intended to tell her story. And according to the deal Pecker reached with prosecutors, he did it to help the campaign. Sarah Ellison has been covering the story for The Washington Post. She joins us from New York. Sarah, for months, the paper, the National Enquirer, has been saying all of this was just a coincidence. They were never working in concert with the campaign.
Right.
What are we seeing now?
Well, we're seeing a major reversal on that. And you're absolutely right that for months from the get-go, when the Wall Street Journal first broke this story days before the election, until as recently as earlier this summer, AMI was constantly, it was repeating itself in different ways, and its executives were saying, we supported Donald Trump and wrote positive stories about Donald Trump in our pages, but that was just an editorial decision. And also, it talked about its deal with Kara McDougal as simply an effort to buy her life rights. Mm-hmm. They put her on the cover of some of their fitness magazines. They said this was all just sort of basic tabloid business, and that has been now 100% reversed in a way that is very significant, not only for AMI, but more importantly for the president.
Well, now, according to the agreement, as you write, Pecker offered to help deal with these negative stories to assist the campaign in these stories so they could be purchased and their publication avoided to help the campaign.
Yes.
Look, some of the lawyers for these women are saying that's illegal. Is it?
Well, certainly, if you are a publication and you are controlled by a candidate and you are giving what is essentially a major in-kind donation, that amounts to a campaign finance violation. And that is what – I mean, what we see them doing now is be sure that they won't be prosecuted for those actions, because they are more useful to prosecutors at the SDNY for the information that they can provide for their ongoing investigation. But there's a real question, and it seems like these are now because they were done with the purpose to influence the election. They seem to fall very squarely in the category of campaign finance.
Initially, Trump denied knowing about the payments.
Right.
Then he said that they were simple private transactions, mm-hmm. and that Michael Cohen is lying about his having directed mm-hmm. them. But now that AMI and David Pecker are saying essentially the same thing, mm-hmm. it would seem that there's a plot being revealed here. And we remember when the tapes over the summer when tapes surfaced mm-hmm. of that conversation that Michael Cohen recorded secretly in 2016 with then-candidate Trump. And you can hear Cohen talking about his plans to set up a company and mentioning our friend David, which has long been thought to be David Pecker of AMI, to help. Let's listen.
I need to open up a company for the transfer of all of that info regarding our friend David, so that I'm going to do that right away. I've actually come up and I've spoken to Alan Weisselberg about how to set the whole thing up with funding.
And Alan, of course, the money man in the Trump organization, and talking mm-hmm. about, how do we get money to David Pecker, mm-hmm. presumably now to pay off Karen McDougal for her story. David Pecker has long been a big supporter of the president. In 2011, he launched the website shouldtrumprun.com. Mm-hmm. He reportedly kept negative stories about him in a safe. He mm-hmm. knows stuff. What is the speculation about what legal peril this puts the president in?
Well, everyone yesterday was focused very much on the Cohen sentencing, but it's actually much more significant that we have in David Pecker and his chief content officer, Dylan Howard, and as an AMI as an entity, another set of witnesses to the same events and that Michael Cohen has been talking about. And so Cohen was always an imperfect witness. He's admitted to lying. Donald Trump has really gone out of his way to discredit him. And he was going to be problematic because whenever you've admitted about lying about one thing, it's hard to be a credible person to say that you're telling the truth about this thing. But now you have a second corroborating set of witnesses, and that is very, very serious for the president, and it's very good for the prosecution.
Yeah. You even have, and you make an end note, that AMI, this publishing company, would send digital copies of the tabloids' articles and images of Trump or his mm-hmm. political opponents to Michael Cohen in advance of publication. Mm-hmm. It's quite a relationship. Sarah, we're going to have to leave it at that, but thank you so much for your reporting. Sarah Ellison covers media and politics for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it's been a turbulent year at the University of Southern California. Hundreds of women sued USC's former gynecologist for sexual assault and the university for negligence. The school's president resigned in July. And in October, university leaders agreed to a $215 million class action settlement. But through all this, students say they've been ignored, and USC's initial efforts to address the problem didn't include them. From KPCC, Adolfo Guzman-Lopez reports on a class this semester at USC that's finally giving students a voice.
The class is called Why Me Too? Sexual Violence in American Culture. The goal? Understand sexual violence on campus and stop it. Case study number one, former USC gynecologist George Tyndall.
All right, let's get started. Good afternoon.
During the semester, Professor Ange Marie Hancock Alfaro guided students through allegations from hundreds of women who say Tyndall performed improper pelvic exams, made sexually suggestive comments, and took photos of them naked. Students also studied how sexual assault is investigated and how universities are run, which leads to this day's lesson. Hancock Alfaro tacks five large sheets of paper on the classroom walls.
You will see up on each of the sections of the classroom different pages with the problem that we've identified as a group over the past 10 weeks, and then the proposed policy solutions.
One sheet identifies the problem that students aren't getting enough information about sexual assault. The proposed solution, create a student app filled with sexual assault resources. Political science major Carissa Velasquez finds one and shows it to her classmate on her laptop.
There's an app called Here For You. It says provide students with resources if they're a victim of assault, as well as information on how to help a friend. And I guess that's at Loyola in Chicago.
Her classmate writes that on the sheet.
Okay, it's time for the fourth 10 minutes.
One of the most popular sheets is the one that says there's a campus-wide problem with communication. Senior Anushka Siriman says that when university administrators began proposing reforms earlier this year, students felt sidelined.
I don't think that there was any say in how to solve the problem, especially with like the Board of Trustees being so distant from students and officials just kind of concealing the problem as well.
One idea students come up with is town halls between USC's Board of Trustees and students. Another, says international relations major Priscilla Escalante, would make it part of the trustees' job to help stop sexual violence on campus.
So we thought that it would be a good idea to include like a department or like a specific group within the Board of Trustees that focuses primarily on sexual misconduct within the school and like to combat it.
Other ideas include audits of sexual assault reporting, opening a 24-hour rape treatment center on campus, and a sex ed column in the student newspaper. Siriman is proud to have contributed to the proposals.
It's empowering to know that we could possibly do something to end this like 30-year era of trauma.
Professor Hancock Alfaro wants to build on that sense of empowerment. She says her class will create a survey and fan out around campus to collect input from other students.
The only way to reform a culture is to actually talk to and engage the people who are participating in that culture. So certainly that includes students. There are 30,000 of them here at USC or more.
The proposals won't gather dust on a shelf. They'll be collected in a document that'll be given to the Board of Trustees and top administrators. Still, some students are skeptical. Senior Valerie Lopez says an experience with a campus sexual assault group a few years ago makes her wonder whether students will be taken seriously.
I have a feeling it's going to be like the task force that I was in. All this hard work's put in, thought put in, and nothing comes of it. They're not going to do anything with it.
In a written statement, USC Interim President Wanda Austin says she looks forward to reading the students' recommendations. USC, Austin says, has started incorporating student voices into committees and task forces studying reforms. USC social work professor Devon Brooks co-chairs one of the task forces. He read some of the students' recommendations.
I think they're fantastic, and I think there's a lot of convergence between what the students are coming up with and what some of the other committees and task force and informal groups or individuals are coming up with.
The students who took the sexual violence class say they'll be watching closely to see if USC adopts any of their recommendations. For Here and Now, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Arctic Report Card, released this week, warns that the warming Arctic is causing widespread environmental changes. That's in part because a warming Arctic affects water in oceans around the world, which are in constant motion thanks to ocean currents. We're going to spend a few minutes now learning about those. Greg Johnson is an oceanographer at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. He's in Seattle. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Good to be here.
Okay, so if you look at a map of the world with the ocean currents, there is kind of a global ocean conveyor belt that moves water all around. How does it move? What is pushing it?
So ocean currents are actually primarily driven by the winds. There are basically three ingredients. There's the winds, and you have the trade winds at lower latitudes, which blow from east to west. Mm-hmm. And then at higher latitudes, say the latitude of Seattle, you have the westerlies, which blow from west to east. So that's the first ingredient.
Okay.
The second ingredient is the fact that the world is rotating. So there's a force that sets up called the Coriolis force, that adds rotation to the ocean currents.
Which is also why hurricanes spin one way in the northern hemisphere and one way in the southern hemisphere, the Coriolis effect, right?
That's exactly right. And the third ingredient is are the continents. If they weren't there, you'd have currents that went all the way around the world, but they are there. And so you have these gyres that set up that look like huge whirlpools in the ocean. And the fact that the rotation and the continents combine means that actually what happens is the gyres are intensified to the west. So you have these boundary currents that are called western boundary currents that are very strong. A very familiar one is the Gulf Stream in the North Atlantic. But there are others in all the other ocean basins.
How much is our weather and climate based on what the ocean currents are doing?
So ocean currents are important for moderating the climate. They bring heat from the equators to the poles. That is an enormous amount of heat. It's actually as much as 2 petawatts. A petawatt is a watt with 15 zeros after it. Mm. It's about 100 times the rate of mankind's energy consumption. So it's a huge amount of heat. That warmth crosses the Atlantic and the North Atlantic Current and moves up towards Europe, where it gives off heat to the atmosphere. That warms the coast of Europe. We have a similar thing in Seattle where the Kuroshio, which is the analog in the Pacific to the Gulf Stream, brings warm water to the north off the coast of Japan and then flows east towards the west coast of North America and moderates the weather here a little bit. Even though we're quite a bit further north than you are in Seattle, our winters are much warmer.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you look at some of the other patterns that we see on the Earth, like hurricanes, let's say, that they turn into almost a perfect circle. And in the middle, it's like a perfect circle. But the ocean currents are kind of a mess. Why is that? Is that just because of the continents?
They're not a mess. They're beautiful, actually.
They're not circular.
They're not circular, yeah. And that is because of the continents. So the western boundary currents, the Gulf Stream, that is forced by winds all the way across the Atlantic, from New England all the way over to Europe. And it's the cumulative effect of those winds mm-hmm. that sets the strength of the Gulf Stream. So as those winds vary, the strength of the Gulf Stream varies. But it varies slowly and really with a lag. It takes a couple years for that wind energy to make its way over to the western boundary in the ocean and show up as a change in the Gulf Stream strength.
How long does it take for ocean currents to change?
It depends on where you are. The Gulf Stream, it takes a few years to change. The global conveyor belt, which you mentioned earlier and I'd like to get back to, is more like a decadal time scale, so 10 years. But currents in the tropical Pacific and along the coasts, where planetary waves, which are not exactly like surface waves, but they're much larger scale, can convey energy quickly, those take on the order of weeks to months to change. So El Nino, another worldwide weather phenomenon, happens when the trade winds relax in the Western Pacific, and there's warm water that's been piled up by those trade winds in the Western Pacific, but that water rushes eastward in a matter of months and helps to warm up the Eastern Pacific and change weather patterns around the world. That can happen quite quickly.
And is that based, are El Nino and La Nina, are those based on ocean currents and what's happening with them?
Yeah, it's the interaction of the winds and the currents again. So during a La Nina, the trade winds are stronger than normal. That pushes water along the equator to the west. It pulls cold water up in the eastern Pacific and cools down the eastern Pacific and changes weather patterns. When those trade winds relax during an El Nino, the water rushes to the east, shuts off that cold upwelling in the eastern Pacific and changes rain patterns and actually patterns of winter warmth around the world.
So let's talk about the global ocean conveyor belt. When was the last time we saw a big change in its patterns?
There are two parts of the global ocean conveyor belt. People talk a lot about the North Atlantic conveyor belt. That one shifted around 2008. It started to reduce strength. We have an array. Scientists have set up an array of instruments across the North Atlantic that go from Florida all the way to Africa, and they measure the strength of that current. And we've been doing that since about 2004. And the strength of the meridional overturning circulation reduced a little bit in 2008, and has continued to be fairly low, low of the earlier values since then.
Why?
Why? Well, that's a good question. It's actually a vigorous scientific debate. My wife is an oceanographer at the University of Washington, and we actually debate this over the kitchen table. Mm. So one possibility is that the meridional overturning circulation is slowing down in response to global warming. That melting of ice and increases in rainfall up in the northern latitudes have made the water there less dense, less likely to sink and flow south back towards the equator. That happens at the high latitudes. The water is normally cooled. As it's cooled, it becomes denser, and it'll sink right to the bottom and then flow southward along the east coast of North America under the Gulf Stream, which is flowing northward. There's a big cool patch now over the last couple of years between Greenland and Europe that shows up when the meridional overturning circulation slows down because you're bringing less warm water northward. And so the ocean cools there. There's warming off the east coast of North America, off New England. Higher sea level rise goes with that warming. So those are all possibilities. But there are other scientists who say, in fact, that this is a more like a decadal oscillation in the winds. They're removing more heat from the ocean east of Greenland, and it'll take a while to sort that out, I think, whether this is a decadal oscillation or a long-term change.
What about the stuff in the water? And I'm thinking both of living things like fish and where they move around and where they migrate, and also the garbage piles, the plastic piles in the Pacific that swirl around, huge hundreds of miles of plastic swirling around. Is that all driven by these currents, where fish are and where garbage is?
So let's start with the garbage, I think. So the Great Garbage Patch in the North Pacific is a direct consequence of ocean currents. You have trade winds at low latitudes that are blowing from east to west. And then again, at high latitudes, you have the westerlies. And so you have water flowing north from the near the equator, and then also water flowing south from the higher latitudes. And they carry with them plastic and garbage. Those currents actually concentrate the garbage in a garbage patch in the middle of the North Pacific. There's a similar one in all the oceans.
And what about fish?
What about fish? Certainly the currents will move them. There are these fascinating storms in the ocean. You mentioned hurricanes in the atmosphere. They're analogs in the ocean. They're very slow. They take years to cross the ocean, but they're called eddies or rings. And those can actually carry a little ecosystem with them away from where they originated from to where they end up.
So how much do we actually understand about ocean currents? And I'm asking that, obviously we know a lot, but let's say when that plane, MH370, crashed into the ocean And we still haven't been able to find it. And you would think if we really knew with precision exactly what was happening with the water, we'd be able to figure out where something would end up after a period of time. But we couldn't. What do you think? Is that a bad example in terms of how well we understand the currents?
I'm not an expert on aviation, but my understanding is that they didn't know exactly where that plane went down.
Right. But if they did, you think they'd be able to find it?
There's a whole division in NOAA, the Office of Response and Restoration, that actually uses computer models of the ocean that are driven by the winds to try to help track oil spills and, in fact, do search and rescue when people are lost at sea. And a big part of that is predicting the ocean currents. And we're pretty good at doing that in real time in the surface. There are still very mysterious things about the ocean currents that we don't understand, however. I'm part of a program called ARGO, which is a program that has seeding the ocean with 4,000 robotic floats, and they drift down at about 0.6 mile deep for 10-day periods, and we can get a good sense of what the ocean currents look like down there. And there are these fantastic things that pop out that we had no idea were there. There are these east-west bands of current that radiate out from the equator, moving slowly down at 1,000 meters. And so there are certainly mysterious things, but there are also things we know how to do pretty well. And one of those is model the surface currents near real time.
What is the big question that you still have about ocean currents?
My specialty is actually changes in heat in the ocean, and I'm looking at changes down in the coldest, densest waters that form around Antarctica. And that water is slowly warming. And so the puzzle that I'm grappling with is why that's happening. Is it because the global conveyor belt down there around Antarctica is slowing down, or is it because the water that is being carried by that conveyor belt is warming up over time? And that, I think, is an open question and something that I hope I can find out.
That is Greg Johnson, who's an oceanographer at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, joining us from Seattle. Greg, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
And there's a map of the currents at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
It was very insulting to order a writer to go silent. But I am more worried than sour. Worried for my country.
That is the voice of Jamal Khashoggi speaking to the BBC in 2017 about how the Saudi crown prince tried to muzzle him. A year later, U.S. intelligence officials say they believe the crown prince had him killed. Time magazine put Khashoggi's face on its cover this week. He represents Time's Person of the Year, along with other journalists. The magazine is calling The Guardians. And we're joined now by NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
So what do you think is the significance of Time highlighting targeted journalists right now?
So let's take a moment and acknowledge. Usually I feel that the Time Person of the Year is a stunt. It's a way, as the media scholar Michael Sokolow points out, to drive sales at what used to be a slow news time. It is not a slow news time anymore. Time has done something really magnificent here. It's highlighted, I think, this question of the suppression of the ability of journalists to do their jobs through killings, in the case of Khashoggi, in the case of the reporters at the Capital Gazette in Annapolis, or through different kinds of repression in Myanmar with two young reporters who were trying to report on the Rohingya killings there, and also the question in the Philippines, the Duterte regime. They're drawing attention to the idea that regimes can't do this with impunity, that people will pay attention, should pay attention, and they are drawing focus with their very high-profile publication and issue.
You know, what's interesting there, David, is that many of the journalists that Time named are in countries where the governments are not very friendly to freedom of the press. But the journalists at the Capital Gazette in Annapolis are right here in this country, in the United States, where we have, you know, the freedom of the press written right into the Constitution. And it has been a year, and I'm not drawing a connection here between this and that, but it has been a year when people have been talking about some of the president's rhetoric, calling the media the enemy of the people.
Right. I think you're right not to draw a direct line. But I also think it's fair to point out the question of ratcheting up the rhetoric by the president, by some of his allies and some of his supporters against the press. It raises the temperature and it's a problem. If you think about the bomb devices that were sent to CNN and other media figures right. not so many weeks ago, that kind of rhetoric clearly played into the thinking of the person that is at least a lead suspect. We're in an age where the publisher of the New York Times has to say to the president, Arthur Sulzberger Jr., it's okay if you want to say we're fake news. You want to criticize us, that's fine. If you call us the enemy of the people, which the president has repeatedly done, if you say that about journalists, you're targeting us for intense rhetorical attack and possibly far worse.
Do you see any hope for the future in terms of changing people's minds to end some of this hostility toward media in countries, including this one, but also places that are run by autocrats?
Well, I think Khashoggi really highlights the problematic dynamic that we have right now, which is that the Saudi regime clearly has financial inducements to offer the U.S. his oil, take certain kinds of contracts with American firms. The president has made clear he will prioritize commerce, that while the murder of Khashoggi, which has been assigned by the U.S. intelligence agencies towards not only Saudi authorities but probably at the direction of the crown prince, and Trump himself says, we are not going to prioritize that. When you have the supposed avatar of free speech in the First Amendment, the leader of the United States government saying they're not going to prioritize free speech in other countries, it gives a lot of leeway for authoritarian figures to act with certain kind of impunity. And you've seen that reflected in attacks on journalists and also imprisonment of journalists.
It's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thank you.
You bet.
In 2016, students at Iowa's Grinnell College formed the only independent undergrad student workers union in the country for student workers in the dining halls. It was embraced by Grinnell. Around the same time, Columbia in New York formed a union for grad students. That school objected, but the union was upheld by the Obama-era National Labor Relations Board. More recently, students at Grinnell voted to expand their undergrad union to all working students, those in libraries and labs, and this time Grinnell objected, filing an appeal with the Trump-era National Labor Relations Board, which, people worry, might lead to the board reviewing the Columbia Union case and maybe getting rid of student unions, period. We're going to speak to a Grinnell student, but let's start our look with Raynard Kington, president of Grinnell College. President Kington, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me to have this conversation.
So first question, you've been in office at Grinnell since 2010. You were there when the student union
yes.
formed, yep, to support dining workers in 2016. And at that time, the college praised the union. What's wrong with expanding it, including all student employees, someone working in the library or tutoring other students?
Well, when we were approached about unionization among dining workers, we felt that there was no compelling reason not to support that. Those jobs are purely about work. There really isn't an educational component to those jobs. The proposal now is to expand to include all jobs on campus. You know, we just looked at our senior class. Over 90% have worked in their time here. So basically, we're talking about to the entire student body. And it's particularly worrisome that it expands into the sort of about 80% of the other jobs that we believe have a strong educational component. And we're concerned that what has to date been about a relationship between the college and often a faculty member and a student now introduces a third party in an educational setting. And
well,
that's what we think is wrong.
That's because you say, the school says, if I've got this right, that students who, say, assist professors or tutor other students and are paid for that, it's more a part of their education as opposed to work.
Exactly. It's a part of how we prepare students to go out and change the world. In those positions, we don't hire anyone but students for those positions. In the dining hall, we sometimes hire members of our community who aren't students.
Well, and as you well know, the student union is saying that this on-campus employment is part of many of their members' financial aid packages. So we're employees on Grinnell's tax forms. And they are worried that there's something else afoot here. Now, the school has filed an appeal with the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board. And some of the students and some education analysts say that this NLRB in the Trump administration has indicated it is against student unions, period. It will side with the school against the expansion, But that also opens the door for the board to look at the entire idea of student unions and maybe go so far as to overturn the 2016 decision allowing the unions at private colleges in the first place. Is that your goal?
I mean, that is not our goal. In fact, we've stated clearly in our appeal that we believe that the Columbia decision was applied in an overzealous, expansive way to our setting. We're not objecting to the dining hall unionization. It's functional now. What we're saying is that the merits of the Columbia case were argued based on what was overwhelmingly graduate students in very different types of positions in the positions that we're talking about. And we believe that just applying the Columbia decision to our undergraduate situation isn't appropriate.
Well, but are you at all concerned that this particular NLRB board would overturn the Columbia decision, that would then take away the precedent that allowed students to unionize at all and jeopardize even the dining workers union at Grinnell?
What we have to do is to make decisions based on what we believe is right for our mission. It's just unreasonable to think that in our day-to-day decisions, we have to think of ourselves as, in essence, sort of making decisions for the entire country or all of higher education. We have to focus on the issue before us. And the issue before us is it appropriate to have a student union for these expanded jobs on our campus?
That's Raynard Kington, president of Grinnell College. President Kington, thank you so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed our conversation.
Well, now let's bring in Quinn Ekerlani. He's a junior at Grinnell College and president of the Union of Grinnell College Student Dining Workers, which, as we've been saying, has expanded to include all the students working on campus. Quinn, President Kington says he supports the union for dining hall workers, but, as you well know, is against the expansion because it throws too wide a net. He says these are jobs that are part of the student's education. Each is individual and should be negotiated by educators, not a union.
Well, I'd say that all jobs have educational aspects to them. And also, the fact that the job should be negotiated on an individual level, I can understand that argument. However, there is no negotiation that goes on without a union. It's just unilateral changes that are made by the employer.
Well, as you know, your case is going to a Republican-led federal labor board. It's likely you'll lose. That's what most analysts are saying. The school will win. And that could lead to the NLRB revoking the 2016 Columbia decision, which set a precedent for student unions. Now, President Kington, he says it's apples and oranges. Columbia had its first union for grad students. Grinnell is for undergrad. But did you worry about that in pursuing this, that in proceeding with this expansion, you might ultimately have this consequence of impacting negatively the ability of students across the country to unionize?
Well, I mean, we've known that was a potential outcome from the beginning, and that's why we've been doing our work on campus. Our efforts on campus have been focused at trying to get Grinnell to not appeal. Kington said that it's apples and oranges. However, his own legal filing done by Proskauer Rose explicitly seeks a review of Columbia. So while he's saying that it may not overturn Columbia, I mean, his legal filing suggests that this is being done with the express intent of doing just that. And I would also add really quickly that the unit that we currently represent in dining services at Grinnell College was actually formed before the Columbia decision was handed down by the board.
And by the way, why? What was the great need for a union for dining hall workers in 2016?
After the Great Recession, there were no student wage increases for approximately 7 years, and tuition at the same time had continued to rise. Additionally, there's a bit of a problem on our campus in terms of making sure that the terms of employment for all student workers are equal.
You mentioned the salaries were a part of the impetus to do this at all. And Grinnell now pays non-union student workers a minimum wage of $8 an hour compared to the minimum wage in the state, Iowa, which is $7.25 an hour. Now, your union has proposed raising that from $8 to $9 an hour. In return, you've pledged not to strike or do any work stoppages for at least a year. But, you know, just a devil's advocate question. Why do you think students working on campus should make more than maybe even their parents working off campus?
Our adjusted cost of living every year doesn't adjust with inflation. It adjusts with the rise in tuition, generally speaking, around 3 to 4%. So the wage increases that we see, even if they were just adjusted with the regular wage increase as it's seen across the state, we're going to actually see a wage reduction in terms of our ability to pay for the necessary good of attending this college.
You, meanwhile, are an independent union. You don't have an international affiliation, therefore no legal support from some big national union. Do you worry about that?
Frankly, I think that it makes the college's arguments weaker. They say that the union is going to be inserting, you know, a weird third-party economic-focused relationship into the academic relationship that students already enjoy with their institution. However, we're not a third party. We're just a group of students. I do worry about the fact that this makes our fight less sustainable and that we don't have the resources and legal expertise. However, it also provides students on our campus really great experience to get to know the system for themselves and to practice this Grinnellian value of self-governance.
Yeah, I think you probably this will probably be the thing that remains with you long after you've graduated. Quinn Ekrelani, president of the Union of Grinnell College Student Dining Workers. Quinn, thank you.
Thank you.
And again, before him, we spoke with the president of Grinnell. And now we're talking here about private schools and student worker unions. Some have backed down in recent disputes out of a concern that they would lose their case before the president's NLRB. But the Grinnell students say they're going to stay in the fight. So what do you think? Your thoughts welcome. HereAndNow.org.
And it is December 13th. We are winding down 2018, which means it is time to find out Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunn's favorite cookbooks of the year. We're at that time of the year. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
And we hear that this was a tough year for you to do this. Why?
It was a tough year because there were so many good cookbooks. Yeah. And I swear I say it every year. I literally went through over 100 cookbooks to kind of cull it down and try to find dishes that I found really exciting.
You know, people don't know that there are so many cookbooks, and we get them, you get them. I mean, we talked about this. I recently carded, I mean, a U-Haul's worth of cookbooks, you know, to people who needed them more than me. Because, you know, they're pretty, you love them.
You mean
them.
People who cook?
These are students, you know, like,
absolutely,
right?
Sure.
But because, sometimes I feel if I hold a cookbook, I'm actually cooking. You're not. So what is it that you want in a cookbook?
Well, I want to learn something new. Yeah. I want some inspiration. I want to understand something new about a cuisine. And this collection really taught me about Indian spices. Mm-hmm. It taught me about baking unexpected combinations. It taught me inventive ways to use leftovers. It taught me about Israeli food and Middle Eastern food and California restaurants. Mm-hmm. And one of the themes that really came through this year, because we need it more than ever, is community and belonging and sharing. Because after all, what is food if it's not about sharing and community?
Yeah. And you get that in a cookbook.
You do. A lot of these cookbooks are full of messages. So let me start with what I don't want to say my favorite because, you know, it's sort of like, who's your favorite child?
Okay.
But Nick Sharma, I know a lot of these people. Yeah. I need to come clean and say that. Some of these people are friends. The food world, it turns out, is quite small. He wrote a book called Season, Big Flavors, Beautiful Food. This guy is young. He is immensely talented. He not only developed this collection of outstanding recipes, but he also took the photographs. Many people may know his blog called A Brown Table. And in his blog, he writes a lot about his life as a gay man in Northern California and his immigrant roots. Mm-hmm. And the theme of this book is taking Indian spices and bringing them into everyday cooking.
Okay.
So you both have this gorgeous bowl of yogurt in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I want you to take your spoon and stir it up. So it's yogurt, salt, and pepper, and a little bit of water.
Can I just say, I tweeted this out at Here and Now, Robin, so you could just see, I mean, there's beautiful,
it's so
there's purple and
beautiful.
Orange.
So it's red beets, golden beets, carrots, and scallions grated on top. But the trick is this. This is where the spices come in. You heat up black mustard seeds, curry leaves, and grated ginger in canola oil. And when it's hot and the seeds have popped like popcorn, you put it on top of this yogurt. Mm. So you taste the layers of flavor and the colors. His food is just gorgeous. I also tried his toasted cumin and lime cucumber salad and the spiced beef kebabs. And I'll tell you, I just am diving in. I just want to cook Indian food all year after reading this book.
Jeremy, this is
It's harder than it looks. I mean, I remember we did a segment with an Indian chef recently on Here and Now, and it is much harder. You've got to really be firing on all cylinders to make it work.
You know, I would say that Nick's book breaks it down, but you do need to have the spices. Next is a kind of really interesting, inventive book called
Pie Squared.
Pie Squared, yeah. Mm-hmm. Irresistibly Easy, Sweet, and Savory Slab Pies by Kathy Barrow. So what the heck is a slab pie? She kind of reinvented the pie. And you may ask yourself, does it need reinventing? For those that struggle with pastry and crimping and latticing, she has you cooking pies in a rectangular baking sheet. You throw the dough in. It's functional, it's beautiful, and it almost always serves a crowd.
It's like a casserole.
Well, it's kind of a slab pie. So she has fabulous ideas for crusts. There's a cream cheese crust, there's a cheddar cheese crust, a caramelized onion crust.
And I can taste the gorgonzola here.
That is a spinach gorgonzola and walnut slab pie. Boy, it's a very inventive group of recipes.
Okay, got one last one.
Yes,
which
you
looks
do.
A bit more desserty.
It is dessert. This is Everyday Dory by Dory Greenspan. This is one of the friendliest, most approachable, appealing books of the year. Yeah. Dory Greenspan's known to a lot of people for her baking books. Can you guess what this cake is?
Cranberry.
Yeah, there's definitely cranberry, but the unknown.
I know because you told me, but I can't believe it.
It's a parsnip cake.
Can you believe that?
Oh,
so
wow.
Think of a carrot cake, but you use parsnip, a very sweet root vegetable. It's brilliant. It's got a cream
really
cheese
good.
Frosting. It's got cranberry layer. And you know, did it take me some time to make it? Sure. Was it worth it? 100%. But this book also has these wonderful recipes, chicken and salad Milanese style. There's a twice flavored scallop and an umami burger that I'm dying to try that's got oyster sauce and soy sauce. Greenspan has written many books. This is definitely one of my favorites.
Okay, we just have time maybe for one more of your favorites.
Yeah.
Another thing this year are memoir/cookbooks. Von Diaz, who is also a friend, wrote a beautiful book called Coconuts and Collards, Recipes and Stories from Puerto Rico to the Deep South. Yeah. This is about a cuisine we know so little about. Oh. Puerto Rican food, turns out, is wonderful.
We're going to have your whole list at hereandnow.org. And we would add your book, Soup Swap, fabulous gift. Kathy Guns, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.